Hello, I'm Luis Hernandez, and welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Well, back in March, the FBI took over City Hall in Opa-locka. They questioned the mayor and other city officials in a widespread corruption probe. No one was arrested at the time. This past week, the Miami Herald put back the curtains even more and showed us how numerous political figures were using their power to extort money from the citizens for things like business licenses. Now, to understand this narrative, let's back up a little bit and remember former Opa-locka city manager Steve Shiver. Why is he important? Remember, he was fired in November after just 3 months on the job. The Miami Herald reported Shiver was fired after he asked for help from the state in resolving the city's $8 million deficit.
Not paying employee benefits after they were taken out of their paychecks, not paying vendors timely, owing the county millions of dollars. You can't just brush this under a rug. In the financial reports adopted by this commission and this mayor, it was detailed over the last several years these problems were coming. So unfortunately, they chose to, not they, the mayor chose to do this, and you'll see more to come.
So what did Shiver uncover? He probably unveiled this shadow government. And we come back to the current Miami Herald report that actually named names this past week. Well, joining me now in studios, Jay Weaver and Mike Sala of the Miami Herald. And we ask you, if you live in Opa-locka, what experience have you had trying to do business in the city? And we call to any of the city leaders. Call us now. Tell us your side of the story. 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can also tweet us at WLRN. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/group/ The Florida Roundup. Mike, Jay, it's such a pleasure to have you here in the studio. Let's start with this. Let's understand, what does the FBI have and what are their intentions? Jay, I'll start with you. Mike, jump in anytime. Where's the FBI in their investigation at this point?
Well, the FBI is on the verge of working with the U.S. Attorney's Office to return a grand jury indictment to charge several people in the city of Opa-locka, including politicians, city officials, employees, and a lobbyist, with racketeering-type charges of extortion, kickback schemes, bribery, you know, the usual litany of corruption activities. But it's different in this case. And a case that's been building for 3 years has now kind of reached a climax. And a grand jury is convened in Miami as we speak. And we expect very soon that it will be returning an indictment charging as many as a dozen or more people with participation in this racket.
Mike, why was it that back in March when they showed up at City Hall, nobody was arrested?
Well, at that time, that part of the investigation was still, let's get more information. And they basically disemboweled City Hall of all the records, documents, even their electronic data to essentially back up what they've been building on for the last 3 years. And we suspect that some of the time and maybe a little bit of the delay in moving forward, maybe that they're still wading through an enormous amount of public records, documents, budget matters, contracts, things like that, that will more than likely.
And so they have that information. And also in this, Jay, in this past story, is you pointed out one particular resident who lives in Opa-locka, who is trying to deal with the city leaders and basically handing over thousands of dollars, in the extortion money. They have, wiretaps. The FBI has wiretaps on some of these city leaders. What more do they need? At what point do you think they actually do move forward and start arresting people?
Well, in these types of cases, there's always history, and then you have to have, direct proof. And the direct proof will be the sting operations that the FBI directed using this business owner. He identified himself as Frank Zambrana. He owned a farm equipment business. He was trying to attain a lousy $150 occupational license to sell equipment on this storage lot.
And as you pointed out, it was just meeting after meeting after meeting with different city leaders handing over money, constantly handing over money. At what point did Mr. Zambrana say, wait a second, when did he reach out to the FBI to reach out to him?
Well, sometime in 2013, he got very frustrated because he wasn't getting his license. And he was paying out from his own pocket about $3,000-$4,000 at that point. And so when the last shakedown occurred, he said, I'm going to the FBI. Now, it wasn't that simple. There was a lot of worry, a lot of concern, a lot of frustration, and a lot of emotional toll. You know, this man was a father of five, had a son who was dying of cancer at the time. He couldn't make a going of his business after he had been, you know, doing this for a number of years. He's a Nicaraguan immigrant, and he was living in North Miami, but the business was in Opa-locka. So at one point, you know, he just snapped, and he said, I'm going to the FBI. The FBI, would you agree to wear a wire recording device and do a series of, you know, payoffs to these different politicians? And the politicians just got more and more greedy. The lobbyists got more and more greedy. And the city manager got involved, and he got more and more greedy. So all of this is recorded, videotaped, and it's evidence that will support the overall scheme.
I want to come back to, Mike, after the March raid by the FBI, some of these people who were implicated, did anybody speak up? Did anybody say anything? I know they interviewed the mayor and some other folks, but I mean, usually when the FBI shows up, people start to get nervous.
Well, they were interviewed by the FBI during the raid, but as far as publicly goes, they've either denied it or they have found ways to kind of say, we actually ran into a couple of them while we were reporting out the Frank Zambrana story, the guy that went undercover. And they didn't want to say anything. They just said, look, I'm not, we're not going there. I'm not talking about it. Never denied it. They just didn't want to talk about it. So they're nervous, you know, obviously.
All right. There was a city commission meeting Wednesday. No one said anything. None of the city leaders spoke up. No one in the crowd said anything after the story.
I was there. It was deafening. And not only that, but it was surreal because the commissioners were talking about real nickel and dime stuff to try to get their financial house in order because they're under real financial straits. The state is considering whether to, take over the city's finances and run it. They are millions in debt. And so they talked around those issues quite a bit, but this never came up. One of the commissioners was going to bring it up. And then later on, he told a few of us in the media that he decided not to because the city attorney thought it would not be best to bring it up. City attorney denied that. But, you know, to get beyond that, what was more remarkable is that David Shiverton, the city manager in the middle of all this, who's been accused of shaking down Frank Zambrana for bribes, never addressed the issue, nor did Commissioner Santiago, who was also there. And the mayor actually said this is all a ploy of the Miami Herald to get us off track on our road to financial recovery.
And again, I come back to this fact that nobody in the audience spoke up and said anything, because I've seen some of the video, the Herald video, after the raid, and people saying, finally the FBI is involved. Finally, they're going to do something. We have a corrupt government, and nobody spoke up. These are the people they elected.
Right. It doesn't square. There was a lot of applause outside the city hall on March 10th on the day of the raid, thinking, okay, the cavalry has finally come in to rescue us. But the other night, there must have been 50 or so, you know, residents in the room. And apparently, they were there for other reasons, specifically, you know, water issues and water bills. But they never even talked about that. The Citizens Forum was silent as silence can be.
Keep in mind, too, you know, there's a great sense of fear. And Jay knows this as well. We both in our reporting have found a lot of people very afraid. There's always been a feeling that you can't really come out in front of these leaders and call them out on it, because then
afraid of what?
Well, they're afraid of retaliation. Remember, these are people that have used police officers. They've used others that we can't even identify to carry out their schemes. This is not just people making threats. They carry out their threats.
Is that also probably why other city leaders didn't speak up at all?
It's certainly publicly in front of everyone. They'll certainly do it behind the scenes. And when the FBI was there, they were very emboldened. But when you see them in front of they're on the dais, in that position of power, there's a lot of fear that goes through that community.
I mean, I post the invitation again. Anybody from Opa-locka, resident or city leader, call in. We'd like to hear your side of the story. 800-743-9576. All right, so let's come back to Steve Shiver. He was, again, brought in to handle the, you know, deal with the city finances, and instead was fired a few months later because he went to the state to talk about the city's financial problems.
If you'll recall, before being abruptly terminated as city manager in November of last year, I pointed out several irregularities and things that just didn't make sense about their financial systems there. At this point, I hope and pray that our justice system will rapidly resolve this issue and allow the good citizens, the business owners, and the residents of Opa-locka to finally move forward.
I wonder if, you know, going through this story and again looking at all the different people, because it's from city, a city commissioner to a lobbyist to public works officials involved in this, is this a really well-organized network that they are running, or is it just arrogance because of power and they think they can get away with it and they have been for a while?
Well, I think there's a climate here. I mean, we need to step back, and I think Mike was alluding to it when he was talking about certain individuals, either city officials or politicians or lobbyists, who have a long history of kind of running roughshod over their residents, over other employees in government. Everybody's a little afraid, and that's putting it mildly. So you have the intimidation factor, the retaliation factor. And this is a very poor city with a long history of corruption. And there have been politicians who have been convicted of crimes, but real small prison sentences, if any at all. And so there's a feeling like you can get away with it, but it is organized, and that's what makes this corruption case different.
And you point that out to a very poor city, and I'm wondering, is it just because of that, that the poverty, is that just kind of a vacuum that attracts this sort of corruption, or is it just easier to get away with things in a place like this?
No. The corruption happens everywhere. Miami Beach and their code enforcement department had a big case that went down. Miami-Dade County, there have been major cases in various departments. Same with the city of Miami. Same with Coral Gables. It really has been more surgical in those instances where they take out certain officials or certain departments. This seems to be systemic. It's just a culture of corruption in Opa-locka. And there are a few that do organize it, but they use code enforcement and the police to kind of wield their power, their influence, and their intimidation.
All right, let's talk about some of the characters in this story. City Commissioner Luis Santiago. Mike, what role does he play in this?
Well, he was elected in 2012. He has taken on the position that he can shake down business owners, according to the people we've interviewed. He has shaken them down for thousands of dollars. He wields the kind of influence, mostly over immigrants, mostly over people who don't really have a voice. And he gets people who have already invested in the city, their business is there. Now he goes in and he attempts to, and successfully, to shake them down. He has called in others to support him. Dante Starks, a key city hall lobbyist. He has called in police officers to help support him in his extortion schemes, according to the people that we've interviewed.
You mentioned Dante Stark. City lobby. Who is this guy?
Dante Starks is a former Miami-Dade police sergeant. He was fired from the police department after numerous complaints of sexual intimidation and assault. And then he came on the scene. He worked for a while as a Miami-Dade chief of staff for then Commissioner Doran Roll. Now he has found himself in the last several years in Opa-locka as a unregistered lobbyist until recently. And he's taken upon himself to also get involved in shakedown schemes and other things. He was charged and he was convicted in a large-scale bribery scheme with Commissioner Pinder a few years ago. He's back at it again.
All right. Jay, I also wanted to ask about the mayor's role in this. This goes back to the FBI raid back in March. There was a connection with Mayor Myra Taylor pressuring Mr. Shiver into giving her and her husband money. But what role does she play in all of this?
Well, that's a good question. I think in the overall scheme of things, I don't know of direct evidence showing that she was paid off. Frank Sembrana never paid her off directly, but Frank Sembrana did pay off her son, Corleone. He's not a city employee. He works for the city's garbage contractor, Universal. The mayor herself was implicated by Steve Shiver in a bribery scheme over back payments to a contractor who had built a pump station and wanted several hundred thousand dollars paid to him that he had not been paid. And so Steve was being pressured by the contractor and the mayor's husband, who's a bishop, a pastor. And the idea was to pay off the contractor, and some of that money, exactly $150,000, would be kicked back to the mayor. Now, this never played out. It never came to fruition, but that's how she was pulled into it. But there's a history of the mayor and her husband and alleged kickback schemes.
All right, I want to take one call. Again, I have put that invitation out to city leaders from Opa-locka, but let me go to Bill in Opa-locka. Bill, welcome to the program. Bill, are you there?
Yes, hello.
Go ahead, Bill.
Oh, yeah, thanks. No, I just happened to catch your show today. I find it pretty interesting. I actually have a second home in Opa-locka. I'm a snowbird, if you will. And actually, I don't know, 9-10 months ago, tried to do some renovation there and had applied for some permits. And actually, to my amazement, I never really talked to anybody. I never really called to turn it in. I'm, you know, it's like, hey, you know, it's, I was a little bit in disbelief, but I actually did get shook down a little bit for some payola to get some permits expedited on a small addition. So it's pretty fascinating to hear this dialogue.
Who was it you were dealing with?
Well, it was the city, and again, you know, we've gone forward on some permits, and you know, during the process too, during the inspections, was actually getting hit up for some down money, if you will, to expedite the whole permit process.
Were you asked to give extra money under the table in cash or something like that?
Exactly. It was actually a cash payoff. So it's pretty interesting to hear all this going down. But I tell you what, it's crazy. I listened to this conversation. I was just sitting here a minute ago. I was driving. I heard you mention the name Colleone. I don't know. It just sounds like something out of The Godfather.
But it happened to you. All right, Bill. Thank you so much for the. I appreciate the call. I do. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. Wrapping up here, Jay, Mike, do you see anybody going to jail? What happens next? We come back to the question of the FBI probe.
Well, I do. I mean, I think that the FBI is building a very strong case, and a combination of the public records they've gotten and the testimony on the wires and the video recordings that are just stunningly revealing. Yes, I do. And I think that the people that we wrote about last Sunday, I believe, will be charged, and I believe there's going to be additional ones.
But nobody's in hiding. Everybody's just business as usual, right, Jay? I mean, nothing's – everybody's acting like, okay, you know, they're just waiting, or
– There are rumblings that the city manager may step down. There are rumblings that he could be stepping down as early as next week. So stay tuned.
And we will stay tuned, and I'll have you guys back in here. We'll talk about that as we continue to see this story in Opa-locka just unfold. An amazing story. I think we just heard from a caller. It's almost like out of a movie. Jay Weaver, Michael Sala of the Miami Herald. Gentlemen, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
All right. Coming up next, we're going to talk about FPL and the Turkey Point power plant. They're facing a deadline in citations by the Department of Environmental Protection. That's coming up next on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, the Department of Environmental Protection has put Florida Power and Light on notice. The utility company has 21 days to provide any information about the Turkey Point power plant's canals and the seepage of contaminants into Biscayne Bay and beyond. There's a meeting of lawmakers, regulators, and FPL representatives scheduled today at the Miami-Dade College's Homestead campus. That's later this afternoon. Eric Szilagyi, president and CEO of FPL, defended the company's environmental record in a recent meeting with Miami Herald's editorial board.
Unequivocally, there is no threat to Biscayne Bay or the drinking supply because of Turkey Point. Period. There have been a lot of things said that are just not true. They are motivated by a variety of reasons for folks, of which I'm not even going to speculate. But, you know, it makes for very salacious and interesting sound bites and headlines.
All right. So let me bring in my guest for this segment. First, I'm joined by Miami Republican State Senator Anitara Flores. Senator, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
Also joining us is Mike Soule. He is the FPL Vice President of State Governmental Affairs, and he is going to be at the meeting as well. Mike Soule, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
And Jenny Stiletovich, a reporter for the Miami Herald who's been covering this topic for quite some time now. Jenny, is always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Mike, let me start with you. Okay, so we heard from Eric Szilagyi, even after the Miami-Dade County report and now the DEP of seepage of these canals, is FPL's position still that there's no seepage, that there's no issue with the canals?
No, that's not what Eric said. What Eric was being very clear about is the drinking water wells that exist in Miami-Dade County are not threatened and have had no impacts associated with the hypersalinity that's associated with Turkey Point cooling canal systems.
Is there seepage? Is there a problem with seepage?
Well, the short answer is, after 40 years of operating the canals, a hypersaline plume has formed underneath the cooling canal system. And that hypersalinity, which is basically salt water that's saltier than average salt water, has migrated beyond the boundaries of the plant. And that is our focus, and making sure that we remediate that hypersaline plume and bring that back to the plant.
And I'm going to talk to you about what that plan is, but I wanted to get, what is FPL's response to the DEP saying, turn over this information on the canals and what you've been doing?
Well, we've been working closely with regulators since 2008, when expanded monitoring was required due to concerns that were raised about whether or not the cooling canal systems were having an influence on saltwater intrusion. Saltwater intrusion is a very complex issue, and so there was a fairly extensive study required by the department, by Miami-Dade, by Water Management District, to better understand the conditions at the Turkey Point plant. In 2013, both the DEP and the Water Management District approached FPL and identified that there was sufficient information to, ascertain that there was a problem and FPL needed to take corrective action. We've been working alongside with regulators since that time to develop the right solution. Unfortunately, there's been a lot of litigation that has slowed some of those solutions, but we are aggressively taking action.
All right, and I want to talk again about some of these solutions, according to FPL, their solutions. Senator Flores, your comments on what you're hearing so far, what you heard from Eric Szilagyi, and where we stand right now with, again, the Department of Environmental Protection asking for all of this information.
Well, I think it's a good step that the state regulators are asking for the information. It's certainly something that is we're grateful for that. I think the question really to DEP that I'll have this evening is why did that take so long? If there are some reports that you know may or may not be true, but you know what are if there have been concerns raised for the last several years, it seems that DEP was a little bit late to the action, and so we want to hear the answers of why that was the case. But I think more importantly is exactly what Mike was talking about as far as where do we move forward on remediation. There is something to be said for the mitigation of the current problem. That's something that's certainly very important. But now that we move forward, now that we know that this hypersalinity is moving outside of the canals, how do we ensure that this does not become a problem for our drinking water? And what do state regulators and state agencies need to be doing to make sure that it does not become a problem for current or future Floridians?
Jenny Stiletovich, we've talked about the issue with the canals at the power plant, and we've looked at it not just from the perspective of, you know, what it might be doing to Biscayne Bay, but also the fact that, as you pointed out before, that we're talking about this issue of the salinity now moving inland, moving west. But really, I mean, what are you taking from this recent move by the DEP in asking for these papers? What exactly are they looking for?
I think, well, they're looking for a better definition of the plume, but I also think they're doing a little bit of catch up. I think a lot of pressure has been brought recently. It started in 2014 over the summer when the canal started running really hot, and frankly, I think DEP they and the South Florida Water Management District have been tracking this for years, and criticism has just gotten so sharp about how slowly they're acting that now they're kind of racing to catch up.
And Senator Flores mentioned that, you know, part of this meeting is to look at what can be done to protect that drinking water, but is it threatened right now? Is it under threat, or have we seen anything telling us that it's already been contaminated?
Well, the drinking water well field that the Florida Keys operates, you know, is not contaminated. The fear is that the salt front is moving westward at a pace that, you know, increases the risk. And critics have said, you know, nobody has acted fast enough so far to stop that, that they've known about the spread for years, going back at FPL's own in-house study in 2010, verified that the plume was spreading and that their solution to it, to add water, might make it worse. This past year, the Miami-Dade County Commission, Rebecca Sosa, asked the UM hydrologist David Chen to take a look at it. He came to the same conclusion. And so I think everyone's concerns are, why is it taking so long?
Senator Flores, you have a lot of people coming to this meeting. And by the way, my understanding is you really helped launch putting this together. Correct?
Yes. I told Jenny, I said, give credit where credit is due. The reporting, I think, is what helped to cause this public view as to, you know, what is the issue here and how the public needs to be informed. And so when I read that report, I asked for the Senate president to convene a special committee of legislators to come to South Florida to hear directly from FPL, from DEP, and of course, most importantly, from concerned citizens to find out what it is that the state's role is. And so the nice thing about this group this evening is we have a bipartisan group from legislators from across the state of Florida, from North Florida, Central, South Florida. We have the incoming Senate President, Senator Joe Negron, who will be joining us as well. And I think all of that just is important to note because it highlights how this issue has become not just limited to a South Florida drinking water issue, but really is an issue of statewide concern.
And you also, if I may, I said, looking at the list, I mean, you got, as you said, you've got different representatives from the state coming in. FPL will be there, the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, Miami-Dade's Department of Regulatory and Economic Resources, the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission. This is a full house. So I'm wondering, though, with all of these different groups, it's not just an information gathering discussion. How do you not let this turn into maybe a contentious discussion? Because people are passionate about this issue.
Well, look, we want to make sure that this is not just an information gathering, but it's a question answering area. And I understand that this is a very important issue. I mean, water is our life source, essentially, down here, especially in South Florida. It's important not just for ourselves, but it's crucial to our economy as well. And so we are going to set the tone this evening that we hope that several people come. We hope that several people will be there. It will also be streaming live on the Florida Channel. So anyone that wants to watch from home can watch on the Florida Channel's website for free and watch the entire hearing. But I feel confident that people will be there in a calm manner, seeing that these are individuals from across the entire state, national folks as well, who are coming because this is an issue of concern. So we want to gather the information. We also want to get some serious answers to questions that are important. And what we hope is that we finish that committee with the framework of, well, what are the action steps that the state will take?
Mike Soul, you know, look, we're talking about a very complex system, a nuclear power plant. You know, help us understand how there isn't a risk, because you can understand how any ordinary citizen wherever they stand on the issue of nuclear power has seen over the decades stories of all kinds of problems and disasters even. You know, there's going to be some skepticism and cynicism about nuclear power. So really, how do you comfort anybody's concerns on whether or not these canals are doing their job, that they're not seeping into drinking water, that they're not seeping into Biscayne Bay and damaging that? How do you answer that question?
I think it's a clear answer. First point, a cooling system, regardless of the power generation, is somewhat necessary for all power plants. And this cooling system is admittedly fairly unique. Most power plants actually take cooling water from the bay, in this case, and return it to the bay and as a normal process. And in the 70s, the Department of Justice actually required the construction of the cooling canals to eliminate that once through cooling and impact to the bay. The issue that's in front of us is completely unrelated to the nuclear process. The issue in front of us is related to saltwater migration into an existing saltwater groundwater condition that is having an impact on saltwater intrusion in this small region. Now, fortunately, we have a significant amount of data that better understands that impact, and we are underway with solutions to reverse that impact.
All right, can you tell us anything about what some of FPL's solutions are, and how different are they from what the DEP is asking of you, what anybody's asking of you?
They're actually not different from what regulators and others have asked us to do. In fact, in the original administrative order that was contested and resulted in over a year and a half of delay of action, we identified the need to eliminate the source of hypersalinity and maintain the cooling canals as they were originally designed to be basically at the same salinity as Biscayne Bay, eliminating additional sources.
All right, now you talk about that, but real quickly, though, because, again, we're not all scientists and we don't all know, but why is the salinity gone up? What's the issue here, and how do you prevent that?
Well,
without getting too technical, don't get too technical.
I'm going to make it very simple, I promise you. The salinity has gone up because much of the replacement water is rain-driven, and unfortunately, over a long period of time, the 40 years, we saw a slow increase in the salinity in the cooling canals as a result of inadequate rain. That was the issue that we need to correct, and that is the issue. The first action that we're taking is to correct that system. So that is underway as we speak. The next question and the next corrective action that we're taking is we are installing extraction wells that will remove the hypersaline water from the Biscayne Aquifer and dispose of it deep into the boulder zone, which is 3,000 feet deep underground. This is the same location Miami-Dade disposes of their wastewater. It's a safe and appropriate way to remove that hypersalinity. We will draw that hypersalinity back to the plant to eliminate our contribution to saltwater intrusion.
All right. Jenny Stadalovich, real quickly, the issue of the canals, and as we've been talking, this is not new. There's been controversy over this for some time. But really, right now, what do we understand about what FPL is doing, what the county has asked, and now what the state has asked for, what the DEP has asked for?
Well, let me just, I want to back up a little bit and talk about what Mike said about the adding water to the canal and the legal actions that were taken. I think part of the concern was that FPL was going to start adding water before they did anything else. And as I keep going back to, the Chen report concluded is if you just add water without doing the extraction process at the same time, you're going to actually make the plume worse. And that was the concern, and that's why the lawsuit was filed. I think now the county, in working out this consent agreement with FPL, says, you know, we want both those things done at the same time to ensure that the plume isn't made any worse because you're adding a bunch of water to decrease salinity and keep the canal water cooler, which is also a requirement of the NRC. Cooling the water allows the canals to continue operating under the limits set by the NRC, but is not really addressing the plume. And that's the big concern that the county chiefly has, is, you know, since they're there to protect our water supply.
All right.
Can I correct the record on one thing?
Go ahead, Mike.
This is important.
All right.
So many people don't read in the original administrative order that the issue of extraction and injection of the hypersaline plume was also identified as a potential solution. Unfortunately, FPL was not provided the 90 days to come up with that plan and went suddenly into a year and a half delay of litigation.
Well, the I'll also say in that agreement that you were given 4 years to bring the salinity down, and I think that was another concern, was that 4 years was a long time to sort of meet this goal.
Mike Zoll, your response?
Well, the system is one that we need to be thoughtful on how we manage it, and you can take quick action, which actually can cause more harm, or we can be thoughtful and make sure we make our decisions based upon the data, based upon the science, to ensure that we're successful in the end, and that's our focus.
Okay. This is obviously a very complicated topic. We'll come back to it. Senator Flores, I'm going to give you the final word here. We're short on time, but you hear this discussion, you hear this, the back and forth, and, you know, we didn't even go to the phones to ask people mm-hmm. their thoughts on this. What do you expect from today's meeting? How are you going to, respond to some of these things that are going to pop up?
Well, we expect for us to finish today with some action to figure out what do we need to do to make sure that this is not a problem. It's encouraging to hear that FPL has a plan, and so we need to find out, we need to make sure that that plan is implemented quickly, and if that plan needs to be expanded, then that is what the state will be requiring for that plan to be expanded, and that's what we expect this evening. Again, the meeting will be from 4 to 8 p.m. and the Miami-Dade College Homestead campus. For those of you who would like to watch it at home or elsewhere, you can watch it on the Florida Channel's website, which is thefloridachannel.org. And I suspect that this issue will not go away after this. This is an issue that we will continue to monitor over as long as it takes, quite frankly, as long as it takes to make sure that it doesn't become a bigger problem.
I've never heard of an issue this complex being resolved in one meeting. Miami Republican Senator Anitara Flores, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you so much.
We also heard from Mike Zoll, FPL Vice President of State Governmental Affairs. Mike, thank you for the time. I know you're going to be at the meeting. You're heading down there now. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Jenny Siletovich of the Miami Herald, it's always a pleasure. Thanks again.
Thank you.
All right, coming up next, we're going to be talking about human smuggling, the issue of bringing in Cuban baseball players to the United States, another group, found guilty of doing this. Will new relations between the two countries end this? We'll find out. That's coming up next on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez in for Tom Hudson. All right, get-rich-quick schemes are real shady. It's even worse, though, when you're talking about running a scheme that involves smuggling people. This week, Miami baseball trainer Julio Estrada was charged with smuggling Cuban players, baseball players, from Cuba through Mexico into the United States. Along with help from agent Bart Hernandez, they collected millions from these players. A Chicago Tribune story reported that Cuban star Jose Abreu paid more than $5 million, almost $6 million to these men. Will this continue now that the U.S. and Cuba have these new relations? And also, staying on the sports theme a little later on, we're going to talk about the Miami Dolphins and day one of the draft. But joining me again is Jay Weaver of the Miami Herald. All right, so, this is a complex story, but breaking it down easy, the story of smuggling players from Cuba, not new. What's new in this case?
Well, what's new in this case is that you have the added element of extortion. In the old days, and this, as you pointed out, has been going on for years, players were smuggled through Cuba into a third country, Mexico, for the purpose of being able to negotiate as free agents and not be subject to the Major League Baseball draft. Why do you want to do that? It's more lucrative. You can negotiate with different teams. And so you're coming through Mexico, you're establishing a kind of a residency in Mexico, and then you obtain visas to come into the United States. You obviously can negotiate a much higher contract with different teams than you can if you're just subject to one team.
But those teams can't negotiate with you if you're coming straight from Cuba.
That is correct, and that's why you have to go to a third country. So Major League Baseball, for years, has turned a blind eye to this practice of these agents bringing the players into Mexico, or even the Dominican Republic or Haiti, but mostly Mexico, for the purposes of establishing a kind of bogus residence in Mexico. And then they have training down there, they have housing down there, their families are brought down there, and then eventually they're brought into the United States after they have obtained proper visas from our government to enter this country. But here's the difference. With these cases, there's an allegation that these agents and their associates extort the families stateside, and they extort the players for bringing them into the United States. It's not just a fee anymore. They want a piece of their big Major League Baseball
almost
salary.
$6 million from Jose Abreu?
Oh, he's not even the first. There have been several before him. The first one that was on the map in this case is a guy named Leonis Martin, whose family lives here in South Florida. And he went to the Texas Rangers. He's now with the Seattle Mariners. And Bart Hernandez had a huge lawsuit dispute with him playing out in the Fort Lauderdale Circuit Court. It's now a Major League Baseball arbitration matter. It predates the Abreu case by a couple of years. And it really was the same situation. It was a dispute over millions and millions of dollars on a $20 million contract that were to be paid to Bart Hernandez. The Abreu case, we're talking about Jose Abreu, was more recent. He's playing with the Chicago White Sox. And he, as the Chicago Tribune reported from documents filed here in the Miami Federal Court, was was shaken down, for lack of a better word, according to authorities, for $6 million. And so Bart Hernandez worked hand in glove with Julio Estrada. Now, was any of this illegal? The government in the United States says yes. Prosecutors say yes. And they're charging these guys for unlawfully bringing these aliens into this country and defrauding the U.S. government.
And those are the actual charges. I mean, because going through the story, you know, it was, you know, paying off these boat captains, bringing, you know, just sneaking these guys around, bringing them in through the United States, having fake documents.
Correct.
I mean, it seems like there should be a laundry list of things that they could charge them with. But
there are, but you can only, you know, you have to charge what you can prove. And in this case, it's a conspiracy case. These guys, you know, Hernandez and Estrada, are accused of conspiring to defraud the United States government for doing all the things you just said, violating Trading with the Enemy Act, directly dealing with Cuban ballplayers when they shouldn't be, really kind of circumventing our laws as they relate to Cuba, bringing the players through Mexico to obviously, you know, gin up their value to, you know, cultivate, you know, really lucrative negotiations with Major League Baseball teams.
So part of the new relations between the U.S. and Cuba, and this was announced last month, was that now people in Cuba, workers, can start to talk with companies outside in the United States. And, of course, that could mean baseball players. Does everything that's changed over the last year and a half, does that do anything to stop this sort of behavior?
It will. And eventually this will become a moot point, because what you're going to have is normalized relations. You're going to eventually see a repeal of the Cuban Adjustment Act, which gives certain residency to Cuban players. You're going to see the Cuban people who try to come here treated like any other immigrant group. So they're not going to get any special privileges. So they're not going to get any special visas when they come through Mexico to come into the United States. They're going to be treated like Haitians, Nicaraguans, Dominicans, anybody else. So what really distinguishes this now has only been the fact that for years you've been seeing these players brought in by these so-called unscrupulous agents and trainers. When they spot talent, they bring them in and they take advantage of them. But it's gotten worse because they're accused of extorting them now.
This is a fascinating story. I'm waiting for the movie, because you just get the feeling this is going to turn into one at some point. Jay Weaver, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
All right, coming up, what I want to do here in these last few minutes is staying on sports real quick, because, of course, we are in the NFL draft. All right, you were watching last night, right? You were watching as the Miami Dolphins, with the 13th pick, chose a controversial player. Now, some people really love this idea, and other people are just shaking their heads. But you know what? Instead, I'm going to bring in Adam Beasley, Miami Herald sports reporter who covers the Dolphins. Adam, great to have you back.
Yeah, I'm happy to be on.
Okay. You know, I wasn't just watching the draft. I was also watching guys like you on Twitter. And as we got to pick 9, pick 10, pick 11, all of a sudden, a lot of the players the Dolphins wanted kind of disappearing. And then you guys were all, you were mentioning it. Uh-oh, that means we're going to be left with Tunsil. What was going on? What was going on as we were coming up on the Dolphins pick?
Well, it seems like every year there is this one guy that slides, right? I mean, Aaron Rodgers is the best example. Back in the same year that Alex Smith was drafted first overall, he went all the way down to the mid-20s to the Packers. Sometimes it's just a confluence of events. Teams don't need a quarterback. But sometimes there is just this jaw-dropping occurrence that really changes the game. Last year is Lyle Collins, an offensive lineman who very tragically had had an associate of his murdered right around the time of the draft, and he had not been fully cleared yet by police. He fell the whole way out of the draft. Ultimately, he had nothing to do with it. and the Cowboys got themselves a heck of a player undrafted. This year, obviously, it wasn't as precipitous of a drop, but Laremy Tunsil had the same kind of phenomenon. He, offensive lineman out of Mississippi, you talk to guys like NFL Network's Deion Jeremiah, they say he is the best player, period, in the draft. Well, how the hell does he fall to 13th? But the answer is this. About 13 minutes before the draft starts, there is a video that surfaces on his hack Twitter account of him smoking marijuana through a bong with a gas mask. I mean, this is just, the visuals are unbelievable. It's something out of a horror movie you see, and it was horrific, I'm sure, for Tunsil, who was sabotaged, and for these NFL general managers whose teams are about to go on a clock. And they put so much time, resources, and energy into vetting these guys, and when you have something like this just jar them right before the draft, a lot of these decision makers get cold feet, and basically a dozen of them did. Now, granted, not all of them are going to consider taking him number one overall, but he is a transcendent talent if he can stay on the field.
Who made the choice, by the way? Is it the coach, the GM, and did they have to call Stephen Ross and say, can we take him?
Well, Steve Ross was in the room, so that's, you know, well, they would have to make a long-distance phone call to New York. He was there. He was at team headquarters last night. But speaking to general manager Chris Greer, who the team insists is, runs the board, there was no permission needed to be granted. Steve Ross was on board with whoever they wanted to take, but even as an added sign of confidence, he said, go get this guy. Certainly Mike Tannenbaum has a huge say as well. He's the former Jets general manager who is the, for lack of a better term, the football czar for the Dolphins. He really is the guy that orchestrates everything that happens in an organization.
So we know this. I mean, this is a great player. The Dolphins have needed offensive line help for a while, so it's going to help. But you know, there is that question though: if a person, players with questionable checkered pasts, you never know what you're going to get. Is there? I mean, are they more confident than they are concerned?
Well, I mean, they have to be at least a little bit concerned because they have recent history. Deion Jordan, they traded up to third overall back in 2013 to take this dynamic pass rusher out of Oregon, and he's played about a half dozen games for the team in the past 3 years because he can't stay sober. He just finished serving up a year-long drug suspension, and we don't even know if he'll be reinstated back into the league. He failed a ton of drug tests.
Real quickly, because I only have a little bit of time here, two things I want to get to. One, today's draft, day two of the draft, what are the Dolphins looking at?
Well, they still need a cornerback, right? They have a huge need at that position. They could go running back as well. And certainly pass rusher is an option as well. They're in the mid-40s, early 40s. They'll get a good player with that pick.
All right. I heard this story. Dolphins are still looking for a name for the stadium. And they're either talking to what, Hard Rock or Qatar Airlines, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly two of the options. I think Hard Rock might have a little higher of a likelihood of getting done. But, yeah, they're going international, aren't they?
Hard Rock Stadium for the Dolphins. I don't know. Qatar Airlines, Miami Dolphins. What do you think?
I think whoever pays them $1 more than the other guy is going to get the naming rights.
You know what? I guess if the Dolphins, I'm willing to bet if the Dolphins win, then nobody's going to care what it's called.
No, give me a roof to guard me from the sun and a winning team on the field, and I'll be happy.
All right. Adam Beasley, Miami Herald sports reporter covering the Miami Dolphins. Thanks, Adam.
All right.
And you know what? You can share your thoughts. Tell us what you think about that. What do you think about the draft? What do you think about changing the name of the stadium to Qatar Airlines or Hard Rock? Or maybe you have an idea for something else. You can always find us on Twitter. Find us on our new Facebook page as well at WLRN. Thank you so much for joining us for the Florida Roundup. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a great weekend. Mm-hmm.